Hello, everybody. So let's welcome Alan Gates from Hortonworks. He will speak about Hive 2 and SQL speed and scale. Please.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, everyone, for coming. So I only have two speaking slots at this conference, and they're back to back. So I guess they just wanted to get done with me, like, over. Anyway, so I want to talk today about stuff going on in the Hive community. I've been a member of the Hive community for three or four years now. And so I wanted to share a lot of the things going on in Hive 2.0. And I want to start by saying, you know, I'm talking about a lot of this. And obviously, much of this was built by the community at large. So I want to recognize that. I also stole some slides from some of my coworkers, Sergey and Sid. And in case I forget to say Apache in front of any of the other projects here, I'm covering my bases there. I've called them all Apache something or another up front, so there we go. I'll start with a little bit of history, and then I'll, just to kind of set the stage, I think that's actually one of the problems with people that have been around a long time. They want to tell you stories about the old days, so in Hadoop speak, I'm an old guy since I've been doing things around Hadoop for 9 years now. So I'll start with a little of that to kind of set the stage and then go from there on what's happening now and talk a little bit too about work going on in the future. So where did Hive start? And initially, Hive was a SQL layer for Hadoop. It was, you know, Hadoop came out, you could do MapReduce on top of Hadoop, you had to write Java code for that. Not everybody wants to write Java code, and so Hive was built really as a SQL to MapReduce translator. That was where it got its start. And it was good for that. It was used mostly for ETL. There were big batch queries. Most of them were going to run for minutes, maybe even hours. So fine-tuning a lot of the performance was focused around how to make joins faster, not so much around how to make the queries, you know, query startup time and those kind of issues fast. Sometime around 2012 or so, it became clear that people weren't thinking about Hadoop just as kind of a big batch engine anymore. They were storing more and more of their data there, and they wanted to do more and more of their data processing there, including data warehousing type tasks. And that was a little different focus than what Hive was, but it was and still is the biggest, most used SQL engine on top of Hadoop. And so the Hive community started shifting to, let's take on some of these traditional data warehousing problems. Let's not just focus on big ETL. Not to say we want to leave the big ETL world behind, because we don't. It's still there. It still works. But we want to focus more and more on how can we do more of these traditional data warehousing things. This is not OLTP, obviously. This is not, you know, you wouldn't want to run your shopping cart app on this. That's not what it's based. That's not what it's built for. It's very focused on more traditional BI type problems, and those sorts of things, analytics. So this change, though, was not without a little bit of stress and controversy in the Hive community. As I said, Hive was a successful SQL to MapReduce translator. And as we started pouring in these new features to support data warehousing, that caused a little bit of stress. People who liked Hive as it was were like, why are you doing this? Why are you adding all these new features? Why are you putting these new parts into Hive when Hive does everything I want and all you're doing is, you know, breaking the code that I care about? And it became clear to us that realizing the full potential of Hive as a data warehouse was going to require even more of that, right? That the people that were working on the data warehousing side had a lot more to do. The people who weren't were getting more and more frustrated with the amount of new features going in. So as a community, we decided the best way to handle this was to have different lines in the community. And so we kept the Hive 1 line, which is still there. And the promises in that line is that it's stable, that we won't add things that risk the stability of the system, that all the changes will be backward compatible. We won't be breaking stuff. But people, you know, we continue to put in bug fixes. And you're welcome to put new features in there as well, as long as it doesn't break these first two guarantees, right? It's not like we're saying this is bug fix only or those sorts of things. It's just you can't put big new things in there that might destabilize it. At the same time, we started working on the 2.0 line and pouring pouring a lot of the new features in there. And in that line, we said, we'll be backwards compatible when we can, but we don't promise we always will be. So Hive 2.0, the first release, came last February. There were over 1,000 JIRAs resolved in that, so you can see a little bit of what I'm saying about, you know, stability and breadth of changes and that kind of stuff. And 2.1 was released in June with somewhat smaller number of JIRAs, but still fairly significant. I would classify both 2 and 2.1 as beta releases of Hive. I wouldn't really recommend that people put their production workloads on this yet. We are working toward making a more production-ready release, and I'll talk more about that later. But I wouldn't classify us as having arrived at that place yet. So what are some of these things that have been added that's, you know, such a big deal? There's a lot of stuff in there. I can't talk about all of it because this talk is 1 hour long, not 3 hours long, and because my voice would give out and you'd be bored before I got done. But I want to pick out a few things to kind of highlight. We've added procedural SQL, which we called HPL SQL. There's a huge change with what's called LLAP, which is a set of standing servers. There's a lot of work on in the Hive on Spark stuff, changes in the cost-based optimizer, lots of things I won't have time to cover. And then I'll finish by talking a little bit about some of the cool work that's going on right now that's continuing to drive some of this stuff forward. So I'll work through each of these areas. And then I'll also talk a little bit about some of the, you know, I referenced that 2.0 wasn't 100% backward compatible. What were we going to change? I'll talk a little bit about that too. What did we break and what do you need to watch out for if you're using Hive 1 and you want to switch? So the first thing to highlight here, the addition of procedural SQL. So if those of you who are at some point in your life used Oracle might know this as PLSQL. Teradata, I think, calls their equivalent just stored procedures or something. I'm not actually 100% sure of their name. But a number of these existing commercial databases have some way to basically take SQL and make it Turing complete, put in branches, put in loops, so that you can really write a procedure in it. You add for, while, loop, if, that kind of stuff. That's what HPL SQL was, so it's bringing the same functionality to Hive. The person who worked on it, one of his goals was to make this as close to the existing flavors out there, like PLSQL and Teradata's stored procedure language, so that the port from those to this would be of minimal effort. It's obviously not zero effort, because there's no standard here. Not everybody does it the same way. You have to pick some way to do this. But he tried to minimize that so that it'd be as easy as possible for people. The one caveat I would give here is this is currently external to Hive, and I mean external in the way it sits in the system. And it's part of the Hive community. It's checked into Hive code. But the way it runs is it has a separate binary where you hand it this, your HPL SQL script, and it then makes calls into the JDBC driver. That's not the end state we'd like, right? We'd like the end state to be that this is actually inside Hive server, Hive Server 2, so that you can submit HPL SQL over the JDBC connection, but we're not there yet. The next big area I want to talk a little bit about is called LLAP. And let me give a little bit of background to kind of set up what this is and why it's important. So as I already mentioned, Hive started out as a big batch engine, right? And in that world, the jobs you were doing took minutes or hours. Nobody cared if it took 30 to 60 seconds to get your job started, because you were going to spend 15 minutes or more running it anyway, so optimizing away that 30 seconds was a complete waste of time. Well, as more and more people wanted to do more traditional data warehousing type queries in there, that problem flipped around on us, right? Also, we discovered, actually, even though it's big data, and people do store a lot of data, a lot of their queries actually were only scanning gigabytes, not terabytes. And so even if all you're scanning is, you know, if you're going to scan 100 gigabytes, 30 seconds to set up that job to do that is still, you know, that's a pretty big penalty. So a lot of the work in Hive went into how do we push down that startup time. And a lot of it could be pushed out. by switching from MapReduce to other engines underneath, such as Tez, by rewriting a lot of the operators to be faster. There was a lot of work that could be done. But at the end of the day, the way Hadoop works is you submit a job that spins up some kind of application master that then goes and gets resources from Yarn and spins up resources inside the cluster. You just can only push that down so far because you're spinning up a lot of JVMs in there. And you're doing a lot of communications back and forth with the server. And so you find yourself with about a 5-second gap or 10-second gap that you just can't get rid of because of the way Hadoop works. And so what are we going to do about this? We don't want to give up the fact that Hive works well on Yarn, that it can do these really big jobs where it needs to say, okay, I've got to scan a terabyte of data, and you're going to have to give me, you know, hundreds or thousands of containers to do this. But at the same time, we want to work well in that small thing, right? And so LLAP is what we came up with as a way to do this. And LLAP stands for Live Long and Process. And yes, we did steal that from Star Trek, hence the hand there. And the idea here is Hive now has persistent daemons that can sit in the cluster running all the time. This obviously saves time on the startup. You know, when you issue a query, you don't have to go spin up tasks necessarily to run that query. It also turns out that a lot of the efficiency of having standing processes isn't just the startup time. There's also Java's JIT. So the just-in-time compiler in Java is actually speeds up our code, we found, very significantly. And by starting a new Java container, a new JVM, every time we're running a new query, you're giving up the first few 100,000 records running through JITted code, and they're running much slower. By running them all, running multiple queries in the same JVM, we get to take advantage of that, the JIT having already been run. We also gives us a place to cache hot data in memory, right? And so LLAP can do that. The cache is aware of the way tables are partitioned and aware even of the columns inside the table. So it can cache not just sections of the, not just tables or partitions, but even only hot columns in particular partitions of a table. So that it's optimal, it's attempting to be optimal in the data it's actually caching, not picking up whole parts of the row that nobody cares about. And it's the system is written such that whenever possible, we do schedule work on a node where data is already cached. Now, we don't assign particular query segments. We don't hardwire particular parts of the table to particular nodes inside these LLAP daemons. So let's say there's a set of data that's very, very hot. Everybody wants to read that right now. We don't make every task that needs to read that block line up on one node. If there's a node that has that cached and that node's full, the request will get sent to another node which will then cache that data block, and the next queries that come along can hit that new cached location. This keeps us from needing to, from binding on mapping a particular block to a particular node, and it gives us a way to make sure that we're caching, using the cache to let more readers read that same amount of data. This is more than just a cache, though. Operators can actually be executed inside LLAP when it makes sense. And I'll show you a slide next that kind of makes this a little more clear. Sometimes it makes sense to run things in there. Sometimes it doesn't. But you can see why with standing servers, even if you're going to need to pull that data out to process it, it still can make sense to push down things like filters and projections. I only need columns A, B, and F. And I only need them in cases where the user I'm talking about lives in Europe. Right? I don't care about users in other parts of the world right now. Pushing those kinds of filters down into the cache obviously makes sense. We can also push other operators in there, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. We assume that other systems will want to be able to read this data efficiently and in parallel, so we're working on an interface to allow them to do that in a way that respects Hive's security. Because since Hive understands the different columns and can do column-level security, this is a way we can serve out our data and maintain that security in Hive. So I was talking a little bit about running things in or outside of LLAP. This is an example. Now, Hive can run on different engines underneath, and I'm using Tez here as an example, and it so happens that LLAP works with Tez and not the others, which is part of why it's in the example. But in a Tez-only world, each of these various squares here would be different containers, right, that would be submitted. Each of those would be spun up and run. You can think of a query here where it may make sense to run the entire thing in there. In that case, all the tasks are run inside LLAP daemons, and only the final reduced task or the final collection of the data is actually run. It says here AM. That's actually shifted. They don't run it in the AM anymore. But you might have one final task that has to collect it together for the user, but that's it. And even that's done in the user space, not in a separate task. There might be cases, though, where it makes sense to read the data out of LLAP, but not process it there. So when would you choose these different things? This is going to make sense when you're doing a very large job that's going to scan tons of data that would flush your cache. It's particularly going to make sense if you know you're not going to read that data again. So say that let me give you an example. Let's say that your kind of bread and butter queries are you're running queries for daily data. How many things did I sell yesterday? How many users came to my website yesterday? Yesterday's data probably fits in your cache. So those are probably going to run over here in the LLAP world. But now maybe it's end of quarter or end of year, and you want to do a quarter over quarter or year over year kind of thing where you're going to process very large amounts of data. You don't want to flush your cache with that large amounts of data, right? So that you want to run more in this model. And the reality is that query is going to run for minutes anyway because it's a year-over-year query. You're going to have a lot of data. At least you hope you have lots of data to read for your whole year's worth of activity. And so that's okay to run here where you're maybe going to pay a little longer startup time versus these, which, you know, the data processing here can actually take just a few seconds or maybe even less. And so you don't want to be paying those big startup times. So how's this working out? Are we seeing the performance numbers we want to see? I have a couple performance graphs for you. The first one is, this is Hive 1 just running on Tez, so in that leftmost one you saw, versus Hive 2 running completely on LLAP. The queries here are chosen from the TPCDS data set. These are a set of decision support queries put out by the TPC. And you can see here the improvement, so the barely visible blue boxes here is Hive with LLAP, and the green one's the Hive 1. And then you can see here kind of the amount of speed up we're getting. So it varies anywhere from, in this particular set, from 5x to about 50x. Just truth in advertising, not every query is faster yet in LLAP. Some never will be, because as I said, some aren't appropriate to run there. And some, you know, we're not 100% finished with LLAP, so it probably doesn't do some things as efficiently as it should. So this graph shows you the good example, not all of them. So let me show you one other graph. This is Hive compared to another MPP system, Apache Impala. Now, I don't show this to try to say we're better than them or not better than them. That's not the point here. The point here is to show we're moving into the range of these MPP systems, that we're now able to answer queries kind of in the same amount of time. Because MPP is a different architecture than Hive started out with. And with LLAP, we're kind of taking a hybrid approach where we're MPP when we need to be and not MPP when we don't want to be, right? So that's so this is an interesting test for us that, yes, we can move into that same range. And you see here, this is, again, from the TPCDS data set. It's about half and half, you know. Half the queries Hive's faster and half the queries Impala's faster. But it gives you an idea of we're starting to work in that same field. So what work's going on in that area right now? As I said, it's currently beta, so we hope to have that stable by the end of the year, or by early next year is kind of our working goal at the moment. Right now, LLAP is read-only. It doesn't have a write path. Now, that is obviously you can still write to those Hive tables underneath, but it doesn't go through LLAP. It's all old style of the writing. That's being worked on. There's a JIRA listed up there that you can see where that kind of the work's going on to make that happen. This is particularly important in the cloud use case because LLAP is particularly useful in the cloud where when you have to fall through to actually read the data, you're not now falling through to HDFS, you're falling through to S3 or something where the performance time is radically different than if you can read it in memory. Obviously, it's radically different even reading it off HDFS versus in memory, but you get yet another step down in performance when you're reading out of an object store, right? Because you're all your locality guarantees and all that stuff are gone. So putting in a write path here is all the more crucial for that. Hive now supports transactions for updates and deletes and that kind of stuff. That yet it is not integrated. That is being done as part of this work on the write path. A big limitation right now is LLAP can't decide for you which of those modes you should use. So I showed you that slide with the, you know, TES only mixed mode or LLAP only mode. Right now, you have to figure that out. You, the user, have to know, oh, this query should work like this. Obviously, that's not what we want. This is something the CBO should be able, the cost-based optimizer, sorry. This is something our optimizer should be able to figure out for you, but today it can't, so you have to do that. In the first implementations of LLAP, it only worked with ORC files, so Hive supports a number of formats, including bring your own format. People commonly use ORC, they use Parquet, they use text, those are probably the biggest three. We started out with just ORC. Other options are currently being added. I think text is being actively worked on, and Parquet is being discussed, I think is kind of where it's at. Discussed as in, like, how will we approach this, not whether we should we do it. And then currently it only works with TES as an engine. That one I don't see changing, actually, anytime soon. There's really tight integration between the way LLAP works and the way TES works, and there'd be lots and lots of changes to change that around. Okay. Shifting gears. Another thing that's a lot of work went in Hive 2.0 was improvements on Hive on Spark. So I talked about Hive can have different engines underneath to actually execute the queries. TES is one option. Spark is another option. So you can run with Spark as your engine underneath. A lot of work went into 2.0 to speed that up, adding things like dynamic partition pruning, which is basically there are times in a query when you can't figure out what partitions you need to read until you've evaluated the where clause of the query, basically. And it's not necessarily possible to evaluate it up front. You have to actually evaluate it somewhat at runtime. For example, when there are join conditions in there, and as you read one side of the join table, it becomes obvious which partitions in the other side you're going to have to handle. So that was added to Hive on Spark in 2.0. It was the Hive on TES already had it. Another area is making use of Spark's persistence for self-joins, self-unions, CTEs, which are the with clauses. And the idea here is, by default, or at least it used to, in Hive, if you did a self-join, so you're going to join A to A, it would actually load A both times, which is obviously inefficient in something like Spark, where you can load it into an RDD once and then read it from there both times. So that's what was added here. A lot of work earlier went into, in Hive, went into what's called vectorized operators. This was a way to run, instead of having operators run over one record at a time in the system, they run over batches of thousands at a time, which is much more efficient. And so work was done here for Spark to make it be able to work on those sorts of map joins. Parallel order by was added, so initially, in Hive, an order by was always done serially by a single task, so they added an option here to make it done in parallel. There was work going on to pre-warm containers. Basically, this was an interesting kind of just mismatch between the way Hive worked and Spark worked. In Spark, you could say, I want X number of containers, but then if you submitted the job while Spark was still out getting containers and maybe it had only acquired X over 2 of those containers so far because, you know, it was busy working with Yarn to grab them all. If at that point you submitted the job, Spark would actually start running it and not bother to give you the other half of those containers you asked. So in one way, it would look like you were being efficient because you were submitting the job as quickly as you can, but the flip side was you weren't getting all the containers you asked for. So the work went on here with Hive to, and I'm not saying that's a bug in Spark. I think it might have been the way Hive was using Spark that caused that to happen. The work went on with between Hive and or in the Hive community to make it work so that it properly waited till it could have all those containers rather than starting prematurely. Support for Spark 1.5, remember again that this came out at the beginning of this year, so I'll talk later about a little bit about Spark 2, and then lots and lots of bug fixes. Okay, another area of interest and a lot of changes is the cost-based optimizer. So let me give you a little background here on optimizers and databases and kind of what this means. So in a Hive started out with only what's called a rule-based optimizer. Those are optimizations where you always want to do them because you know they'll always work. For example, if you have a join clause and there's a, or you have a join in your query and there's a filter clause, you can almost always, well, for certain types of filters, you can push those in front of the join, and that's almost always a win because it means you're going to run less data through your join operator. That's a rule-based kind of optimization. That's what Hive had at first. A number of releases ago, Hive started on adding a cost-based optimizer. A cost-based optimizer is the sort of thing that deals with questions that cannot be answered a priori just by looking at your query. For example, if you're going to join, say you have a query that joins three tables together. So you're going to join table A and B and then B and C. Or maybe you're going to join B and C and then A. Or you have choices about the order you do that join in, right? And depending on the choices you make, the performance of your query can vary radically. And you can't make that a priori just by looking at the SQL. You can't just look at the SQL of the query and go, oh, I know I should join this one and then that one. It's actually dependent on the contents of the tables. That's the sort of thing a cost-based optimizer does. It understands enough about the tables and their contents and the statistics, and it makes estimates about, okay, if I run the query this way, it'll take X amount of time. If I run it this way, it'll take Y amount of time. So which way should I do it? Hive uses another Apache project called Apache Calcite to do its cost-based optimization. Because Hive already had a rule-based optimizer originally, in the first passes, Calcite was kind of bolted on in the side. We're continuing to work on getting that all integrated so that Calcite's really our only optimizer. We're not quite there yet, but we've made quite a bit of progress toward it. One of the big changes in 2.0 is we got enough... We believed enough in this CBO to turn it on by default. In the early versions, the odds that the CBO gave you a better answer than if you left it off were, you know, only so-so. By 2.0, it was giving good enough results that we turned it on all the time. And we focused mostly on those types of queries that I showed you in those performance numbers, the TPCDS style queries. And a lot of focus has been on improving stats collection and estimating stats more accurately because the CBO is completely dependent on the quality of the statistics of your data. If you have bad stats for what data is in there, then you're not going to make good estimates no matter how good your cost-based optimizer is. So this, if you're interested in the cost-based optimizer, Jesus, who also is part of the Hive team and a fellow Horton worker, is going to be talking about this, I think, in the next time slot. So, and he will have way more details and also way more up-to-date information on, you know, kind of what's going on right now, things they're working on. So if that's something that interests you, I strongly encourage you to go to that talk. Okay, as I said, there were many, many other things that were added here. I'll just hit on a few of these, but I won't be able to talk through all of them. So Hive has a number of authorization models in that's available. It used to be by default you got one that didn't actually work. It was sort of just advisory. Now in 2.0 we actually turned on SQL standard authorization, so that means grants and revokes and all the things you're used to from SQL, and it has the advantage that it actually works. It's actually secure. Work has gone into switching storing the metadata from a relational database to storing it in HBase. Hive uses a relational database of your choosing today to store all the metadata like tables and databases and all that stuff. We've done work toward moving that into HBase to get away from that relational database requirement. It's not done yet, but there's a first pass at it. A lot of work has gone into stabilizing the ACID stuff. The early versions of that, there were, you know, not surprisingly, a few bugs. I would characterize that as now production ready. Lots of improvements to Parquet performance. When ORC first came around, you couldn't do schema evolution, meaning the schema couldn't change effectively between partitions, so we solved that. Lots and lots of those sorts of things. Let me spend a little time, too, on what's being worked on now. You know, there's still a lot of ongoing work in this. A lot of time being spent on hardening LLAP for GA, getting it ready so that people can actually depend on their putting their production workloads in it. A lot of work going on in the ACID space. So and I'd like to highlight a couple of these. One is the ACID system in Hive, and I'm sorry, I should explain what I mean by ACID. I use these terms so much I forget that not everybody lives and breathes this stuff. ACID is, you know, the traditional database stuff about atomicity, consistency, isolation, durability, basically what you expect in a database. When I put it there, it's there. Even if the system blows up the instant after I put it there, it's still there. Other people only see it when appropriate. What ACID gives Hive a way to do is support updates and deletes. You know, from day one, you could add new partitions to Hive. You could obviously read the data out, but you couldn't insert individual rows. You couldn't update rows. You couldn't delete rows. With the addition of ACID, you can do those things, as in a, you know, the same you would for any database. Now, again, Hive is not focused toward the OLTP case, so it's not built around assuming that you're going to do hundreds or even tens of updates a second. That's not what Hive will support. What it will support is use cases for things like, you know, slow-changing dimensions where you need to update a dimension table, or, you know, you need to delete records out of the fact table, or you need to restate records in your fact table, those sorts of things. The way Hive does this is when you actually, because you can't change data in HDFS once it's written, right? That's one of the rules of HDFS, so we can't actually update the data. What we do is write the new data on the side in a delta file, what we call a delta file. Then we have the reader can resolve at read time which version he should see, because each of the records is, each of the instances is versioned, and the reader knows which version he should see. And then we come along behind and compact that in a way that doesn't cause any pauses so that the number of delta files doesn't grow too much. That's been there for a while. The way the initial way the delta files were laid out caused us some performance problems, so one of the changes in 2.0 has been to rework the way those delta files are laid out on disk so that they could be much more efficient. We're also adding the merge command into ACID. This is it's upsert, really. What it is I've got this whole batch of records. I don't know whether they're in an existing table or not. I'm going to merge them with that table. If they're already there, then the operation becomes an update. If the record isn't already there, it becomes an insert. So it's kind of, that often gets called an upsert. That's a standard, merge is the SQL standard way to do that. So that's what that's being implemented. In fact, the first patch for this was just checked in this weekend because I was reviewing it on, I think, the plane over here. We're adding support for transactional inserts for tables that don't support update and delete. If you're going to support update and delete in Hive, there's a whole set of restrictions on your table that not everyone's going to want to live with. But we want to add the ability to support inserts without putting those restrictions on the table. The explain command was originally written in, or the results of the explain command in Hive were originally written in Swahili, or something equally hard to understand by most users. Actually, that's not quite true. It was written definitely for engineers that already understood the internals of Hive. It was nearly impossible to figure out. You know, you do an explain query, and you just couldn't figure out what it was telling you. So there was a lot of work to go on to make it actually readable by normal human beings. We've added materialized views to Hive. There's work going on to integrate Druid with Hive. So Druid is a system that does very fast ingestion and can do basically, how would I describe it? Aggregates, measures. It's very good at cubing type of operations. So if you want to drill down all that kind of stuff. Hive isn't naturally great at those. It wants to be good at those. So one of the things we're doing is integrating with Druid so that we can store that kind of data in Druid and still answer the queries very efficiently. And again, Hesos will be giving a talk on that actually tomorrow. So if you're interested in that, please come to that talk. We're continuing to progress toward full SQL 2011 compliance. Hive is not fully 2011 compliant, and there are some old style things we do that aren't compliant, but as we add new things, we always try to be in line with the spec. And so we've added that we're working on adding intercept and accept and extending our subquery support. We do some subqueries, but not all, and adding non-equa joins. And then finally, as I said earlier in the Spark part, they're working on support for adding or for supporting Spark 2.0 as the underlying engine. Okay, let me finish up with some of the caveats, some of the incompatibilities. I said we broke some things. What did we break? So one, we got rid of Java 6 support. I doubt this actually is too big a problem for people, but you never know. Somebody out there might still be using it. Similarly, we no longer support Hadoop 1, only Hadoop 2. I even more strongly doubt that's a problem for too many people, but we'll see. We deprecated MapReduce as the engine underneath. We have not gotten rid of it yet, but we did say basically you should use Tez or Spark. These are much more appropriate engines for the sorts of things Hive is trying to do and much more performant. At some point in the future, we will remove MapReduce. We haven't removed it at the moment largely because a lot of our tests depend on it, and we just haven't had the time to go and rework the testing infrastructure well enough to use only Tez or Spark. Some of the defaults for configurations changed. So as I said, now by default, SQL standard auth is used. So that changes the security situation in your cluster a little bit. Some other things like that, just that if you are using Hive 1, you jump up to Hive 2, these might catch you off guard. And these are detailed in the docs. And then a big one is, we actually plan to remove the command line interface in the future and move just to using the JDBC server as a way to get to Hive. Now, there's still a command line tool for that called Beeline. So you can certainly still script your Hive commands and all that, but we want to be driving those through Hive Server 2 instead of just allowing people access. Why is that? Largely, it has to do with security. It's just flat impossible to secure Hive if people are running in the cluster and have direct access to the file system, which is what you have to do for the CLI. Right? Because the way the CLI runs, everything, all the Hive processing on the front end is actually happening inside your process, which means you have to actually be able to reach out and touch those HDFS files. And that keeps us from being able to secure a number of things, like there's no way we can support columnar security or encryption where we don't want to hand you the encryption keys or those sorts of things in that situation, right? And so we're working on cutting that off to where you would need to go through Hive Server 2. All right, so I think I have about 12 minutes left. That's what I had. I wanted to leave time at the end for questions, if there's any questions. I have 12 minutes, okay, cool. So I have 12 minutes for questions if we have any questions. Yes? Mm-hmm. And I'll repeat the questions too, since I think they're recording this. So the question is, does that mean Druid will be part of the Hortonworks stack? So taking off my Apache hat for a second, putting on the Hortonworks hat, yes. Yes, it will. I don't necessarily know that we're going to stress directly interfacing to that, because one of the Druid's downsides, at least in my view, and others might have a different view, is it doesn't have a SQL interface. So Hive will give it that. But yes, it will be in there. Yes?
You said that the idea of updates on Hive is to do like tens of updates per second, stuff like this. And then there's the end of the merge. Do you have any idea of performance?
So the merge stuff isn't done. So you know, it just, like I said, the base patch just got checked in. There's still quite a bit of work before that's finished. But the thing is, the important thing about the merge, so the way updates work in Hive, you have to, every update that comes in, you have to do a scan to find the associated record. So it doesn't matter whether you're updating one record or 500, you still have to do that scan. Merge can also do it in one scan. So you could be merging in a table of millions of rows, and that actually gets rewritten into a join between the merge, the table you're merging and the table you're merging into. So it's much more efficient. But I don't have numbers to show you yet because we're still working through the implementation. It should be much, I mean, the idea is Hive can right now ingest data at a very high rate per second if it's just inserts, because there's no scanning involved. We're just writing data down onto the disk. So that's exactly why merge came along, because you start scanning all the, I mean, you do all this writing into the disk, maybe every 5 minutes or 15 minutes, you run this merge command to write it in, and then it's there for everybody else to use. Yeah, because people, it became, as soon as we did, it was actually funny, I helped write the ACID stuff with Owen O'Malley, another Hive community member, and we had this argument early on about whether we should focus on merge or something else, and I don't remember what it was. He wanted to do merge, I wanted to do something else, I won, I was wrong, because as soon as we put it out, everybody said, that's great, but why doesn't it have merge? So, oh well. Anyway, okay, other questions? Yes. So the question is it getting in a range where it could be a replacement for HBase? And I would say no, because, well, here's the way I would think about it. When I think things like HBase, key value stores are very, very good at finding one record or finding a range of records, right? Find me Alan's account or find me every account that starts with A, if you're assuming you're storing accounts by username or user ID. That's where HBase is really good, and Hive still isn't going to be great at that because we don't keep individual indexes to a particular record, right? We're still data warehousing. We're still assuming that the queries you do are going to run over some large number of records, whereas HBase isn't making that assumption. So I think the difference is really about access patterns more than it is about, that kind of stuff. HBase is a more traditional transaction processing, or makes a better base for a traditional transaction processing kind of thing, right? Other questions? Yes.
Do you have any idea on when Analytics would also support the Hive part and also the ACID performances would be part of this
Okay, so when will LAP support write and how will that change performance? So I don't think that the write will be as solid. So our hope right now is that by sometime January, February, we can make a GA release of LLAP. I think that will include the write path, but I don't think the write will be really production ready yet. It would probably take another 3 months or something beyond that of pounding on it. That's kind of a guess. Performance, it shouldn't impact the read performance of LLAP because we're doing it pretty in a separate code path, so I don't think it will hurt the read performance. And with the changes that I referenced on the previous slide about rearranging the way ACID is laid out, the read performance on ACID tables is no longer drastically worse than on non-ACID tables the way it was in the past. So in the past, there was a significant performance penalty for reading ACID tables, and that it's not 100% gone, but it's, you know, it's down to a few percentage points. It's not a big deal anymore. Yeah.
Concerning LLAP, it was young, and when containers are allocated, which reserve do you rent? Because when you got your
sure. Yes, so yeah, what user runs LLAP? And the answer is it needs to be a system user. So usually we tell you to create like a Hive user and run LLAP as that, because you're going to be running everybody's queries inside that space, and that user needs to be able to read all the data, right? Now, this has some side effects. Normally, it means that we can't run user-defined functions inside there, right? Because that would be a security breach. And it would also potentially, I mean, a user could screw up and write bad code and either slow down or kill a daemon, which we don't want. So we actually are adding a notion of a blessed UDF. So obviously the system-built UDFs like count and sum and stuff can run in there. The administrator will have the ability to examine a UDF and bless it and say, yes, I'll let you run this inside LLAP. But just if you bring your own user-defined code, that query will get shunted out of LLAP and run in old style to handle that. Any other questions? Sure, go for it. Yeah, can you basically, is there, so I would not, let me rephrase. The question is, can one user take over LLAP basically and stop everybody else? At this point, I would say that that's probably possible. I don't think we've done all the work yet to prevent that. Obviously, we want to do that kind of stuff so that there can be some kind of, you know, similar to the way Yarn today does queuing, where you can control, okay, this user can use at most 40% of the resources, which really means that if nobody else is using them, he can get 100%. But when the system's busy, we need to tamp it down. Now, there are rules about sharing. The one kind of caveat there is what's there today are ways to keep you from bogging down the system with things that can't run yet. So LLAP may have lots of tasks going on, but some of those tasks may be waiting for output from other tasks. It won't run if you've got a query that has maybe half of its tasks can actually run right now. It's what's called runnable. But the other half can't complete yet because they're still waiting for input from these other ones. It will, and some other query comes along and it has tasks that are runnable, it will actually throw out those ones that are waiting and first run the ones that can run. So there's some control for being able to keep from being totally overtaken, but there isn't, I would not say it's complete yet or everything you'd want. All right, I think my time is...
I have 2 minutes,
he says I have 2 minutes, so... So the question is, if we're going after data warehousing, what's merge and insert doing there? Well, merge is bread and butter data warehousing, right? Because if you're bringing CDC data, that's change data capture, in from your OLTP systems on a regular basis, you want to merge those into your tables, right? So that's very much a data warehousing thing. The update and delete and insert, I agree you don't use those near as much as you do in an OLTP system, and that was originally our thinking. It was like, you know, people don't do that here, we don't need that. But what we saw is people started bolting it on the side. At Hortonworks, we had first one customer who kind of honestly does a lot of crazy stuff, so when they did it, we're just like, whatever, they're just crazy. And then another one did it, and we're like, okay, wait a minute. And then, you know, we start to see it over and over. It turns out that even in a data warehouse, you need some changes, right? So here, the use cases we really identified were I'm streaming data in, like, new records, and I want to be able to, I still want that to be transactionally consistent. I don't want my readers to be seeing dirty reads. Slow-changing dimensions, you know, my user changed his physical address, I need to go update that table and note that. In the old-style Hive, you had to actually rewrite the entire user table or the entire partition that user was in to update that. Now you can fix that. And finally, compliance things. Somebody calls you up and says, I hate you, get me out of your system, and you're legally required to delete all their data, right? Again, Hive in the old world had no way to achieve that without reprocessing a lot of data. Now we can do that. We can remove just that one record of them or 10 records or whatever they are in your system and get you out. So those were kind of the things we were headed after. Okay, now I think I'm definitely out of time. Thank you very much, everybody.